Thank you. Thank you. Well, it's a nice pleasure to talk to you again. I'm aware that there's a diverse audience. There's quantum computer people here. There's people who haven't done yet calculus yet. So there will be certainly opportunities for a graceful exit, but also a disgraceful exit. Leave whenever you like as well. So I want to talk about some work in three long papers, the first with Chris Cousins, Dario Martelli, and James Spark, and then a subsequent two papers just with James and Dario. So let me begin by putting the general questions into context. So let's think about supersymmetric conformal field theories that have an abelian R symmetry. So the supersymmetry algebra, anticommutative of two Qs is a translation P. Anticommutative of two superconformal supersymmetries S gives a special conformal transformation K. And the cross anticommutator gives schematically a Lorentz transformation, a scaling transformation D, and crucially the R symmetry R. And just from that algebraic structure, the R symmetry encodes important exact results about the field theory. So for example, if you know the chiral primary operators, if you know what the R symmetry of those operators are, then you know what their conformal scaling dimension is, delta. And you can kind of imagine how you might derive that relationship just by staring at that commutator, given that these chiral primary operators are annihilated by S. And also, the R symmetry encodes important information, but and in addition, it contains information about the free energy and central charges, as I'll illustrate on the next point. But in addition, the R symmetry can be obtained by interesting variational techniques. These have been established over the last decade or two decades. And here they are. So in four dimensions, four space-time dimensions, if we have n equals one supersymmetry, Trilegator and Beck told us about A maximization. And you can consider this trial A central charge, which is a function of a trial R symmetry RT. And you calculate this by calculating this trial to Hooft anomaly combination. So this is a trace over the fermions and the assigned trial R charges. And then you vary this quantity over the choices of RT. And at the critical point, you get the critical R symmetry. And evaluated at the critical R symmetry, you get the A central charge of the field theory. So not only do you get this, you get the R symmetry, you also get the central charge. It took quite a while, but another 7 years later. For three dimensions, three space-time dimensions, there's no anomalies. However, Jeffries realized that if you consider the free energy of the field theory on the Euclidean 3 sphere, then there's a similar story that goes on. So you vary the free energy as a function of the trial R symmetry, and at the critical point, you get the R symmetry as well as the free energy on the 3 sphere of the field theory. Going down one more dimension to two dimensions, this field theory with 0,2 supersymmetry has an R symmetry. And Benini and Bobev in 2012 said you can calculate the right moving central charge in a similar way as a first of all, constructing it as a trial, a function of a trial R symmetry, calculating the Hooft anomaly, varying over the space of RT. And at the critical point, you get the central charge. How about one more dimension, n equals 2 in d equals 1. So d equals 1 is just time, so that's quantum mechanics. As far as I'm aware, there's no proposal for an extremization principle for these supersymmetric quantum mechanics. However, and we'll come back to that point later, however, there's something called I-extremization, which Benini, Hristov, and Zaffaroni came up with. And now we start not with a general n equals 2, d equals 1, but we start with a three-dimensional n equals 2 theory. And then we compactify it on a Riemann surface. So we compactify on a Riemann surface with a topological twist, which allows us to preserve supersymmetry. And if this theory flows to a supersymmetric quantum mechanics in the infrared, on scales much bigger than the size of the Riemann surface, then something called the topological twisted index on S1 cross sigma G can be obtained by an extremization principle in the large n limit. N would be the rank of the gauge group associated with this three-dimensional field theory. So this is a very specific subclass of quantum mechanical theories where there is this extremization principle. An open question is if there's more general extremization principles. But this is a very interesting class, in particular, if this three-dimensional field theory has a dual anti-de Sitter 4 description, then the on-shell result of this topologically twisted index is conjectured and shown in some cases to give the entropy of supersymmetric magnetically charged black holes inside the ADS4 space that approach ADS2 cross sigma G in the near horizon limit. So putting these two facts together, what this is saying effectively is when you can calculate this twisted topological index and it agrees with the entropy of this class of black holes, then you've obtained a microscopic definition or state counting interpretation of the entropy of these black holes. So recall that we have a good understanding of asymptotically flat black hole entropy, going back to the work of Strominger and Vaffer. Calculating the entropy of asymptotically ADS black holes is definitely a work in progress. And this is one of the most interesting scenarios in which to investigate that relation.
Just for symmetric.
Supersymmetric, yes, supersymmetric.
Is that applied for G equal 1 and 0?
In principle, yes. So I'll come back to some open issues here. In fact, a theme of the talk is, as I said, there's three long papers. They're about 80 pages long. I think we've made a lot of progress. But the bigger point is there's many open questions. And you just touched on one of the open questions. Okay, so there are these extremization principles in different dimensions. What is the holographic, the ADS-CFT dual of all these variation principles? Well, it's actually well established in the context of so-called Sasaki Einstein solutions. So let me very briefly review this. So in type 2b, there's these 10-dimensional solutions, ADS5 plus Sasaki Einstein 5, and just the 5-form flux is switched on. So it's the volume of ADS5 plus the volume of Sasaki Einstein 5, and no other fields are switched on. These solutions are dual to a 4-dimensional N equals 1 supersymmetric conformal field theory. So it's a scenario in which we could investigate a maximization, the holographic dual of that. Let me just remind you, or tell you if you haven't seen this before, is that these solutions have a very elegant B-brain description, which also allows me to explain what a Sasaki Einstein is if you haven't seen it before. Sasaki Einstein, by definition, is if you consider a cone geometry. So by that, I just mean a cone geometry with this metric, the r squared plus r squared ds squared at Sasaki Einstein 5. If that cone metric is Calabi-Yau, then by definition, that's a Sasaki Einstein metric. There's an intrinsic five-dimensional definition of a Sasaki Einstein metric, but let me not give that. Let me give you this auxiliary six-dimensional definition. Okay, that's Sasaki Einstein. So you have your Calabi-Yau cone. And then if you count up the dimensions, you can put some D3 brains at the apex of that cone. And then if you look at the back reactor geometry of this configuration, you precisely get this solution of the supergravity theory. In D equals 11, there's a very similar story. Now you start with a Sasaki Einstein 7. So the cone is a Calabi-Yau 4. You put some membranes at the apex of that cone. If you look at the back reactor geometry, you get ADS4 cross Sasaki Einstein 7, and just electric four-form flux proportional to the volume of the ADS4. And these are dual to three-dimensional field theories with N equals 2 supersymmetry, which again are in that class that I was describing before. Now, I told you before that these field theories have an R-symmetry, and we're looking for a variational principle to recover that R-symmetry. So these geometries must have some canonical incarnation of that R symmetry. And in fact, that incarnation is that they have a canonical killing vector. And the canonical killing vector just starts by thinking about the cone, thinking about the vector R d by dr, and then taking that vector, contracting with a complex structure, you get another vector, And that vector turns out to be a killing vector, and it is dual to the R symmetry. Okay, so in a nutshell, this is what the Sasaki-Einstein geometries is. This is not what I want to talk about, but they will come up a couple of times in the talk. How does this variation principle go? Well, first of all, for the n equals 1, d equals 4 field theories, dual to ADS 5 cross the Sasaki-Einstein 5, the A central charge turns out to be inversely proportional to the volume. It's not obvious, but that's a true statement. And for the three-dimensional n equals 2 field theories, dual to the ADS 4 cross the Sasaki-Einstein 7, the free energy on the three-sphere is inversely proportional to the square root of the volume. So remember, the variation principles involve these quantities. So Martali, Sparks, Niao in 2005 said that the R symmetry and then these A and F, or the equivalent of the volumes, can be obtained by an extremization principle where you extremize the volume. But there's an important point here, is if geometrically you want to invoke this extremization principle, you need to go off-shell in some way. And there's no canonical way to do this. I mean, the on-shell solutions, here they are. And what are the rules to go off-shell? You have to find something that's fruitful, I think is the way to put it. And what they did here is rather simple. They said, instead of considering Sasaki-Einstein metrics, let's just consider Sasaki metrics, which means that the cone is not Calabi-Yau, it's just Kähler. So they said, let's consider the space of Sasaki metrics. And then essentially, they showed the volume of the Sasaki metric is just a functional of the space of killing vectors xi. So there's a lot that goes in that statement, which I'm not going to expand upon, but that's essentially what they did. And then you can extremize this functional over the space of all killing vectors, dual to all the R symmetries, and at the extremal point, you get the volume of the Sasaki-Einstein spaces, and hence A and F. So this was a story that goes back to 2005, and for people who know this history, it was extremely important in developing ADS-CFT in a supersymmetric context. So what I want to do in this talk, or at least give you a... Yes? No, leading order alpha prime. Yeah.
The volume can be corrected by...
That's right. So it's just leading order. Okay, so essentially what I want to do is the same thing. This was for four-dimensional theories, three-dimensional. Do the same thing for a class of ADS-3 solutions dual to two-dimensional field theories, and for a class of ADS-2 solution dual to quantum mechanics, each with an R symmetry. And for this case, we'll see that we can achieve it. But as a special subcase, it'll evolve. So this one involves the C extremization. A special subcase of this one will involve the I extremization, and in particular, a connection with black hole entropy in ADS four series. So what are these geometries? They're not to do with Sasaki-Einstein. It's they're of this form. And there isn't such a simple description as brains at the apex of singularities. It's more subtle. So in type 2b, we have ADS3 cross Y7. There's just five-form flux. And the five-form flux is the volume of ADS3, which is two-form. And then this is the self-dual completion of that, where that's the Hodge star on Y7. So there's two things that are different from the previous case. We now have a metric, a two-form, which is closed, and we also have this function B here, which is a function on Y7. So it's a warped compactification of ADS3 and Y7. So the geometry I'm talking about is a triple, a metric, a two-form, and a scalar. By the way, I didn't mention this before, but the L, which appeared on the previous slide for the Sasaki-Einstein as well, is a length factor, which eventually gets quantized when you do flux quantization. Okay, so in 2B, I want to consider this, and I'll demand that it has 0, 2 supersymmetry. And in D equals 11, there's something rather similar, ADS2 cross Y9. G4 is the volume of ADS2 wedge of 2 form. And again, there's a warp factor B here, which is just a function of the coordinates on Y9. And I'll demand that this has two supersymmetries, so it's dual to a quantum mechanics with an R symmetry. And this one, let me just make the comment here that it can arise, this ADS2 class of solutions, as a near horizon of magnetically charged supersymmetric black holes in ADS4 across the Psychion sign 7. So the geometry I'm going to be interested in for the talk, as I said, is what is called a GK geometry, where we have a manifold, odd dimensional manifold in dimensions 7 or above, a scalar function, and a closed 2 form. And I'll tell you some properties about this in a moment, including the definition. So just a bit of history. So in fact, these around 2006, in a number of collaborations, we realized you could construct infinite class of these explicit metrics. So you could just write them down in closed form and calculate everything you like. But somewhat surprisingly, the field theories were not identified at all. Even though you have these explicit infinite class of explicit metrics, it was unclear what the field theory description was. There was a nice paper by Benigni, Bobov, and Crescino, 2015, which made some progress, but that left many, many issues open as well. So the plan of the rest of the talk, and I'll just see if there's any questions after I say what this plan is tell you what this GK geometry is. And then, just like the Sasaki-Einstein case, we have to go off-shell. And you have to decide how you're going to go off-shell in order to derive an extremization principle. So I'll tell you how to go off-shell, and then I'll describe what that extremization principle is. And if I have time, I'll then tell you that you can utilize a new type of toric geometry. So it's analogous to what happens in Kähler geometry, but it's a new type of toric geometry, which is still a work in progress. But there's certain things that work. And using these tools, essentially, we can identify all the dual field theories. And there's a caveat here, and I'll explain what that caveat is later. So there's definitely still open issues here, but essentially, or in spirit, I think we've identified the field theories. So let me just pause to see if there are more questions before we get going.
Of the geofield theory is including specifying the topological twist of Bobini Gombo and Savai-Vijay and Mosuyeri Gombo series.
Yes, exactly. Yes. It's that kind of thing. Okay, and this is also the point for the graceful exit. Please don't feel need to go. Okay, so GK geometry. As I said, we have an odd dimensional manifold, a scalar, and a closed 2 form. Let me consider this action. So this is an action which is an integral over the odd dimensional space. And you can see an Einstein-Hilbert type term here, that the scalar factor B is appearing. There's a kinetic term for the scalar field, and there's a kinetic term for the Maxwell field. So it's sort of like an Einstein-Maxwell scalar theory. So you can just work out the equations of motion for that theory, an Einstein equation, a scalar equation, a Maxwell equation. The GK geometry has to satisfy those equations of motion. We're also interested in supersymmetry, which more precisely means the existence of certain killing spinners. And rather than tell you what these killing spinners are, which is a bit of a requires a bit of some other definitions, which I don't want to give you, I'll give you an equivalent description of what those killing spinners entail geometrically. And an interesting fact is that supersymmetry, which I'll tell you about in the next slide, plus just one equation of motion, this Maxwell equation, actually implies all the equations of motion of this series. So if you have supersymmetry and you impose this, you're actually putting yourself on shell.
So in the case of dimension 7, it looks like you have a closed free form. So should I think of G2 manifolds, or is it completely different?
Which manifold, sorry?
G2?
Oh, no, it's not special holonomy.
So,
In fact, the next slide might clarify slightly that point. Well, it will clarify that point completely. Okay, but this point is going to be important. Okay, so supersymmetry. What is it? Implies it's actually equivalent to. But the first thing that it implies is that the space has a killing vector. And we kind of knew that that should happen because the killing vector was dual to the R symmetry. And just like the Sasaki-Einstein geometry, there's always killing vector. And it has constant norm 1. So there's a killing vector which doesn't vanish anywhere in particular. So let's consider the dual 1 form. Just by definition, you contract with xi and you get 1. So you might like to think about local coordinates. You don't have to, but just in case you just get orientated here. If xi was d by dz, c here is just a little constant depending on n. It's not too important, but it pops up here and there. Then eta would be dz plus p. That would be when you contract that with xi, you would get 1. And in general, the metric can be written in this form. So it's the 1 form squared, and then there's an even dimensional base here, and that scalar function b, which doesn't depend on z in those local coordinates because that's a killing vector, is taken out the front there. And I've taken out the front there because this metric must be Kähler. This is all implied by supersymmetry. So in particular it's Kähler, so it has a complex structure. There's a Kähler form J if I lower an index, and there's a Ricci form which can be obtained by the Ricci tensor contracted with a complex structure, and that's a 2-form rho, which is the Ricci form. And interestingly, all of the geometry is encapsulated by that transverse Kähler geometry. So what do I mean by that? Well, let's look at these results here. Firstly, the scalar field B is just given by, up to a factor, the Ricci scalar of the Kähler manifold. So if you know this Kähler metric, you can work out its Ricci scalar. It needs to be positive, otherwise this wouldn't make sense. So there's a restriction what Kähler metrics you're allowed here. They must have positive Ricci scalar. This 1 form here, if you take the D of it, so if you look at this, it's telling you the local twisting dp, is actually given by the Ricci form rho, up to that constant C, depending on n. And finally, the last bit of data of the geometry is the 2-form F. And the 2-form F is given by J, the Kähler form, plus the exterior derivative of e to the minus b times eta, the same 1 form that appears there. So all of that above here is what supersymmetry means in this context. And I told you before that a supersymmetric solution is if we put the system on a shell, but I only need to imply this condition. And it turns out this condition is this interesting nonlinear equation on the Ricci tensor of the Kähler manifold. So this is the Ricci scalar, Ricci Taylor scalar squared, and the Ricci tensor squared.
So this is not just the scalability of the
Not the integrability. So the statement was supersymmetry plus this one implied all the equations of motion. So supersymmetry is all of that.
Yeah.
And then this condition combined with all of that turns it.
The square of supersymmetry gives you a linear combination of the equations of motion, right?
Yes.
So is that the linear combination that you need to
Exactly. Exactly that. And in fact, you can roughly see it. So F is this.
Yeah.
So when you take the star of F, you're going to get a star here and so on, and you take the D of it, and you have to work. The fact that it's quadratic in the Ricci tensor has nothing to do with higher derivative corrections at all. This is all leading two derivative corrections, two derivatives in the supergravity description. So there's a lot on this slide, but let me just pause to see if there's more questions, because this is the topic of the talk.
Yeah, sorry. Does this geometry have a one-dimensional foliation with the transverse holomorphic structure?
Exactly.
So some analogous to the structure you're planning to
Yeah, so there's a this shows that there's a foliation, exactly. And the transverse metric is Kähler. Exactly.
Is the transverse geometry Clavier just as a holomorphic manifold?
No, this is not Clavier because the Ricci scalar has to be positive.
So something like a fan.
Exactly, yes. Yep. Any other questions? Okay, so we're interested in this class of geometry and we want to develop some extremization principle, which we know or expect should be there because holography and these extremization principles of the field theory are telling us they should be there or are very suggestive. So geometrically, if we're going to go off shell, we have to relax some of the equations of motion. And the way we'll set the problem up is to just consider all the conditions of supersymmetry, but we don't extremize the action itself. So we keep all of this information I just went through, and we just drop this condition here. So we still have a killing vector, we still have this transverse foliation that's Kähler, et cetera, but I don't impose that condition here. By the way, I should have perhaps mentioned, before, just as an aside, in terms of constructing explicit solutions, the stuff that we did back in 2006, you basically go and find a Kähler metric and solve that equation. And a very simple thing you could do is take a product of Kähler-Einstein metrics, and you put that in this equation, that'll be an algebraic equation, and you solve that algebra. There's just a simple flavor of a construction you can do. And that's what was done. Anyway, that's an aside. Getting back to what we want to do here, we'll keep a supersymmetric geometry, but for the moment, will not impose that condition. That's the framework in which we want to consider the geometric problem. So there's some more things I can tell you about, just with supersymmetry, is that the Kohn metric, and here it is, has some interesting properties, not quite as nice as in Sasaki-Einstein, but it's nevertheless interesting. So the cone has an integral complex structure. The R symmetry vector xi is holomorphic on the cone. And the cone has an n+1,0 holomorphic form, xi, that doesn't vanish anywhere. So it has vanishing first Chern class. And this form is closed. And the Lie derivative with respect to the killing vector of this form is some particular number depending on n. So this is not quite as strong as what happens in the Clavier case when you have Sasaki-Einstein geometry, but nevertheless, it's still a very rich set of properties, in particular, integral complex structure and vanishing first Chern class. So we have this for free. It's just changing perspective. Rather than setting the geometry, think about the code. Okay, so most of what's on this slide is what I've just said, and I'll just say it again. So we're going to consider these odd-dimensional supersymmetric geometries, metrics of this form with these conditions here. So I need to specify a transverse Kähler metric. I fix the complex cone, and then I want to choose an arbitrary holomorphic vector xi, killing vector xi, such that this n+1,0 form has a fixed charge. This is a technical point, but it's important to do that to get a good variational principle. So I consider all that data, and then let's return to putting this on shell. Well, to get a solution, we need to make sure that the action is stationary. So let's evaluate the action with all this data. And beautifully, you get this result here. So the supersymmetric action, so this is this thing here, this big mess of things. But when you take all of this and you put it into that action, it just cascades into this form here. So eta is the one form in this transverse describing this foliation. Rho is the Ricci form and J is the Kähler form of that space there. So this is a functional of the Killing vector xi. Well, that's obvious because eta is the dual one form to xi. So it is a functional of the space of Killing vectors as we expected. And it looks like it's also a function of the Kähler metric. But a little bit of work shows that it only depends on a particular topological class. It doesn't depend on the full choice of Kähler of two form, but just on the class. And it's a technical point, but I can tell you afterwards if you're interested. It's just a class in the basic second cohomology associated with the foliation. The most important point is we've now set up a problem where the action is, given that one piece of topological data, is just a functional of the space of Killing vectors. So now we can vary that action, and at the stationary point, it should have put us on shell, and that'll be the geometric version of the extremization principle we're after. Let me just see, is there any questions on that point? Not in detail, but perhaps in spirit, exactly. Yeah. Okay, there's a subtlety, which I haven't mentioned, and for a long time this held us up, but it has a nice solution. For the geometries we're interested in, the 2B and D equals 11 ones in particular, we need to impose flux quantization. That the integral of the 5 form over a basis of 5 cycles is some integers, or the integral of star g over a basis of 7 cycles is some integers. And for these to make sense as statements that only depend on the homology class of sigma a, we need this and this to be closed. But the closure of F5 and the closure of star G4 for a supersymmetric geometry actually require that box R condition. And the box R condition, remember, puts you on shell. So it seems like we can go on off shell. We can set up a variation principle, but we can't impose flux quantization. But we definitely must impose flux quantization. So for a long time, we just thought we couldn't do this, or we had to go in some different direction. But there's it's a technical point, but it's an important one, is that if all the cycles, and this seems to be, this is an open mathematical question, we don't know if this is always the case, but in all the examples we know, this, the cycles can be represented by cycles that are tangent to the Killing vector. That may not be true in general, but it's only true for infinite classes. In any case, let's assume that's true, then instead of imposing this condition, imagine that we just impose the integral of that condition. And if you think of the integral of this side will vanish, and the integral of this side, it's some quadratic thing on the curvature, it turns out that condition, the integral is given by that expression there. So it turns out, and this looks very much just to compare and contrast before this, the action, here it was, eta rho j to the n minus 1. And now this condition is eta rho squared j to the n minus 2, so slightly different. So we impose this constraint, the integral of this. So it's not all the equations of motion, it's just an integral version of them. And this turns out, topologically, to be sufficient to impose this condition. Flux quantization for cycles that are tangent, or represented by cycles of tangent to xi. In particular, here are the flux quantization conditions. And again, it's just variations eta rho j to the n minus 2 now. So again, slightly different here. There's one less power here. And that's because this is a codimension 2 cycle sigma a. Okay, so I can now summarize the extremal problem. We consider a supersymmetric geometry on these odd-dimensional spaces. We have a complex cone, a holomorphic n plus 1 zero form psi. We choose an arbitrary holomorphic vector xi such that x psi has a particular charge under that action. We choose one piece of topological data for the transverse Kähler metric, that class J. We impose this constraint, which was a topological constraint. We impose flux quantization, so a basis of cycles, tangent to xi. We impose all these conditions. And then we extremize the action over the space of xi for fixed J. And if you're not familiar with these kinds of calculations, this seems incredibly abstract and useless. I mean, you think, well, great. I mean, what am I supposed to do with that? It looks very formal. I think I'll have time to flash up a way in which this becomes extremely concrete in the context of toric geometry and very, very powerful. But in any case, now it's just a very condensed, compact notation, this principle. But there's a little bit more. For the special cases of ADS3 cross Y7 and ADS2 cross Y9, the case most interested, the supersymmetric action, suitably normalized, is such that when you go on shell, when you vary the action and you go on shell, you actually get the the central charge of the dual dual field theory. This is just the Heno-Brown 3L2G. And similarly for ADS2 cross Y9, if you take the supersymmetric action, suitably normalized, on shell, it's 1 on 4 times the two-dimensional Newton's constant associated with the ADS2 factor. And now we're have to be slightly less precise in this case. Generically, we expect that this on-shell result will be the logarithm of the dual partition function or the twisted topological index I. And in examples, and generically, we'll expect that when ADS2 is the near horizon limit of a black hole, this quantity is actually the black hole entropy. So this variation principle gives you the R symmetry, and then the action itself is calculating precisely the central charge of the dual field theory in this two-dimensional context, and down here, it's giving you the entropy of the black hole, or these partition functions or indices. So let me just pause again there for a moment to see if there's some questions. This is the main variational principle result. Good. Okay, so then for the rest of the talk, I now want to restrict to special cases. So there could be more, and I think there is more to be done in the general case. But let's restrict to a subset of cases where we can make more progress. So let me start with the 2B solutions, ADS3 cross Y7. And the Y7 I'll take to be a Y5 fibered over a Riemann surface. And there's a very natural physical picture for why you want to consider this. And it's as follows. So let's start with ADS cross Y5, and Y5 has a Sasaki-Einstein metric on it. So as I said earlier in the talk, that's dual to a four-dimensional n equals one supersymmetric conformal field theory. And the isometries of Y5 give rise to global symmetries of the field theory, usually called mesonic symmetries. And three cycles of Y5 give rise to what are called baryonic symmetries. So we have we're imagining a four-dimensional conformal field theory. And then you take that four-dimensional conformal field theory and compactify on a Riemann surface. And you imagine you switch on magnetic fluxes for these global symmetries. You're allowed to do that. And you do this In a way, you preserve supersymmetry. That's usually called giving it a topological twist. So we do that with our four-dimensional field theory. And then if we flow to a two-dimensional conformal field theory in the infrared, we might not. But if we do, then we expect that it will be dual to an ADS3 across Y7 with Y7 fibered as above. And in particular, the structure of the fibration will be precisely encoding these magnetic fluxes that we've switched on. Okay. So we're restricting the subclass of Y7 that are associated naturally with the four-dimensional supersymmetric conformal field theories. And we're going to focus further. The Y5 won't be any Y5. It'll be a complex cone that emits a toric Kähler cone metric. So in the context of Psi-Einstein geometry, the Calabi-Yau cone is toric. So very briefly, and this is just to give you a flavor, and one of the reasons why I want to go through this is to just give you a feeling for how you can actually do computations in the context I'm talking about. So what does a toric Kähler cone metric mean? Well, the cone will be six-dimensional. We must have three holomorphic killing vectors d by d phi I, and they generate a three torus action. And given it's Kähler, you can introduce things called moment maps. So yi can be coordinates associated with those maps. And these coordinates span a polyhedral cone C, which lies in R3. And the cone has d facets specified by the inward pointing normal vectors, VA, that lie in Z3. So the three here is the same as the fact that we have three U1s. So as a picture, and that's all that's really needed here, is here is my polyhedral cone in R3. And it's a polyhedral cone with four facets. So here's my four inward pointing normal vectors. And the picture that you should have in your mind is the full six-dimensional cone is this bit of R3, and at each point in the interior, you have the three torus. But as you go to the boundary, each of these boundaries, one of the circles shrinks. And which circle shrinks along this facet is precisely specified by that vector here. So what I'm talking about, that's all new to you, is just think of a two-sphere. Think of a two-sphere as a circle fibered over a line. And then when you get to the boundary of the two-sphere, the circle is smoothly collapsed down to make this regular point. And here it's exactly the same principle. When you go to this facet, one of the U1s is shrinking precisely, so that's a regular manifold. So these VAs encapsulate a lot of information about the geometry. And the main message is the extremization problem for ADS3 across Y7 with Y7, a Y5 fibered over sigma G, and the Y5 toric. This is still an enormous class of examples. I don't feel like we've gone to something very special here. There's an infinite number of these Y5s. The whole problem becomes algebraic in these VAs. And so on this slide, I'm just going to flash up. And the details won't matter, but the main point I want to emphasize with these formula is that given the Vs, those vectors, specifying the toric data, there's a purely algebraic way to implement that geometric extremization. So just very quickly, there's something called a volume, which is a function of a vector B, which is like the R symmetry. There's some parameters lambda A. And here, what's appearing here, this is a three vector, that's a three vector, that's a three vector, that's a 3x3 determinant. Here's another 3x3 determinant, another one, another one, another one. These lambdas are appearing, which you can think of as Kähler parameters. So you calculate that volume. And then everything, essentially, of the formula I wrote down before can be expressed in terms of V. So the action One more thing. There's a parameter A, which is a Kähler class of sigma G. So the action is A times the derivative of V with respect to lambda ray, plus another term, dV by dBi, and I are the twisting conditions. This expression is the topological constraint, and these conditions are the flux integrals. So for these geometries, there's a preferred flux, the phi form on the fiber. So the flux on the preferred flux is called N. And there's also fluxes on sigma G, the Riemann surface, across a cycling Y5 associated with a divisor. And their fluxes are given by this expression. As I said, the details of these expressions is not important. That's not what I'm trying to communicate. What I am trying to communicate is that if you're given this toric data, these inward pointing normal vectors, then this whole problem of extremization can be boiled down to a completely algebraic one. And then you just take your special example, plow ahead, and you get your answer for the central charge of the dual field theory without ever constructing a metric. Okay, so what we did, for various examples, for example, the Y5 Sasaki metrics, the YPQ, that we just constructed in 2004, you can calculate the dual central charge using the techniques I just described for the ADS3 cross Y7 solutions as a function of the geometric twists and fluxes. And you can compare with the dual quiver gauge theories and do C extremization. And you find exact agreement. And the agreement actually is even off-shell. So before you do the variation over the space of R symmetry, you get off-shell agreement. So we conjecture this would be true for arbitrary toric Y5, and then Hosseini and Zaffaroni proved that that was true. So that's a nice result.
It's
all large N. It's all large N, yeah. So, yeah. Anyone you like. Any toric one. So the toric theory here, remember, we start with the Y5, we start with a four-dimensional quiver gauge theory that has an ADS5 cross Sasaki IN5 dual that's toric. So YPQ, LABC, all of those ones, as you know, many of those, all using these brain box constructs, not brain box, exactly. All of those ones. Take any one of those you like, compact or refine a Riemann surface, switch on all these fluxes, and then you get exactly an agreement between C extremization and this result. So that's, of course, not quite, I mean, showing the central charges agree doesn't show the field theories actually agree, but it's extremely strong evidence. So I think that's what I've said up there. So this provides an identification of infinite class of four-dimensional quiver field theories, arbitrary toric ones, compact finite Riemann surface with these ADS3 cross Y7 solutions. So this is a very nice result, but it's not quite enough to declare victory because there's an important caveat. And the caveat is, of course, the power of this is that I never wrote down a metric. From the ADS3 cross Y7, I just said, if it exists, this is what its central charge is. But maybe it doesn't exist. Maybe it's obstructed. So from the geometric side, there can be obstructions to the existence of Y7. If there is such a Y7 metric with all of the things I was talking about, then we will have calculated its central charge. But they might not exist. And in the context of Sasaki-Einstein geometry, for example, such geometric obstructions are well known and well studied. So this is an important open geometric question. What are the necessary and sufficient conditions for these geometries to be not obstructed? And here we know that there can be obstructions for sure, for reasons I can tell you afterwards if you're interested. So I think this will be the exception. There'll be some a few special cases or class of examples which are obstructed, and generically they won't be, but we don't have a proof. From the field theory, because we're comparing two different calculations, I took a four-dimensional quiver gauge theory, I put it on a Riemann surface, I flowed to the infrared. No one told you that that had to flow to a conformal field theory in the infrared. It could be a confining, it could be a gap theory. If it flows to a conformal field theory, then we have in the agreement. So we again don't know the necessary and sufficient conditions for this condition. But as I said, I think that the generic story is that it'll all work and match. And that's, of course, important to establish. But there'll be some special cases which definitely don't. Let me not mention that point. Okay. Actually, let me just see if there's any questions on that, because I want to move on to something slightly different in a second. Okay, so that was ADS3 solutions. You can do exactly the same with ADS2 across Y9. We now think of Y9 as a Y7 fibered over sigma G, and we don't consider any Y7. We consider the Y7s that are toric. And you can go through a very similar procedure. And using the toric data of the Y7, you can calculate an off-shell entropy function as a function of the geometric twists and fluxes associated with what you've done to the field theory. And this can be identified with the entropy of magnetically charged black holes in ADS4 across Y7. And now the caveat here is that provided that they exist. We don't know necessary and sufficient conditions that there is actually a black hole solution. In a very small number of cases, these black hole solutions being constructed, but we don't know the bigger picture of when they actually exist. So that's all geometry. So there's the ADS2 solutions themselves, and then a separate point is which ones actually come from an ADS, the near horizon limits of an ADS, a near horizon limit of a black hole in ADS4 across Y7. How about the field theory? Well, Hosseini and Zaffaroni in 2016, they did a calculation of the topological index for certain quiver gauge series compactified on Riemann surfaces, exactly as we were considering. And there's a funny little technical point that we can't have any, well, if there's no baryonic twists, then there's again exact agreement even off shell. So this point is a bit mysterious, we don't understand this. But the bigger picture is infinite classes of examples from the field theory side and geometry side are in precise agreement, up to the caveat about whether they actually exist in themselves. Okay, so then to conclude, so the main point is in type 2b, I described this geometric extremization principle is a precise dual of C-extremization of the two-dimensional field theories. For ADS2 across Y9, we also have an extremization principle for the dual quantum mechanics. But this was a case, remember, where I said that these quantum mechanic theories, there's no general extremization principle known. So from the geometry, at least for large n, for a subclass of these field theories, we've shown that there is an extremization principle. So an open field theory question is, when is there a general extremization principle for these quantum mechanics theories? Open question. If the ADS2 solutions arise as black hole horizons, then we're getting entropy via a variation principle, which is interesting in itself. But again, we don't know the necessary and sufficient conditions when one of these solutions is actually the near horizon limit of an ADS2. Sorry, the near horizon limit of a black hole in ADS4. So that's an open issue. Restricting to a subclass of examples is where we can make more progress. So I think more progress can be made here, but restricting to these examples where Y7 is a Y5 fibered over sigma G, or Y9 is a Y7 bivalent over the Riemann surfaces. When these are toric, then we can compare with four-dimensional and three-dimensional field theory results after compactifying a Riemann surface, and we get this agreement. So to the extent that the black hole solutions actually exist, in particular, this class gives a new microscope state counting of entropy. We'll put it this way. Anytime someone constructs or shows that one of these ADS2 solutions is the near horizon limit of a black hole in ADS4, then we have the state counting interpretation of the entropy at hand. And as I mentioned, a big question though is that the geometry can be obstructed. The black hole solutions might be obstructed in the sense there might be an ADS solution, an ADS2 solution, but it's not the near horizon limit of an ADS4 black hole. And there can also be obstructions in the field theory in the sense that you don't flow to a conformal field theory in the infrared. And one thing I didn't mention, but I'll just mention it here, is that the toric geometry, which I went over kind of quickly, one point is, these inward pointing vectors, they define a polytope that must be convex. So in the toric Kähler cone case, these polytopes are convex. But what we actually have done, one of the things that we did is compared these general toric tools with a class of explicitly known solutions. And the some of the explicitly known solutions, these polytopes aren't convex. The exact toric geometry that one needs to describe these Y7 and Y9s, even in this fibered context like I'm describing here, is more general than in the toric Kähler cone case. So the status is we can see things are working, and there's conjectures of how things will work, but there are open mathematical questions. And probably, this is probably the hardest question, because it's even hard in the case of Sasaki-Einstein geometry, is that you might relax these being toric and consider non-toric Y5 and Y7. But generically, we don't know what the four-dimensional or three-dimensional dual field theories are in those cases. So when you start doing this procedure, it's even going to get more difficult. So this may be hard. But I think above there, there's lots of interesting things to think about and work on. Thank you. Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know any way how it's related, but it's, yeah. Maybe there is some way. Status is, I mean, yeah, thought about it a little bit, but can't make any connection. It's a good question.
I think we're able to match with microscopic entropy also in that case. I mean, including higher.
Yeah, so it's slightly orthogonal in kind of motivation because it was exactly trying to go to those high derivative corrections.
But you would ignore the higher derivative if you want.
Yeah. So it's a good question. I don't know.
I forget exactly what the definition of that was, but it was kind of some partition function made with two different boundary conditions.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's like exactly like that. Yeah.
So do you have like the charges here or?
So the charges will be, well, in this context, it'll be the way in which this is fibered over the sigma G. Sorry, yeah, the Y7 is fibered over the sigma G, the twisting that goes in there, as well as. Is actually, in principle, there's also five cycles in here.
Yeah.
And I like the baryonic symmetries, so they can also be twisted or correspond to fluxes. So it sort of seems to be different data, but maybe there is some way.
So there was a constant C, which was like 1/2 to what, n minus 2.
Yeah.
For Y5, that is zero, so the R charge of this 3-4 that we have is infinite.
So, So, yeah. I don't think there, yeah. So it was ADS3 across Y7 was the first one, and then we went to Y9, and then we generalized. So N was strictly greater than 2. I think trying to think of a five-dimensional story, I don't think it makes sense. But if you go to ADS5, Chris Sasaki-Einstein 5, and then you've got the Sasaki-Einstein 7, and then this goes on infinite dimensions, you can think about the Sasaki-Einstein 3. In that case, these are just lens spaces. So it just, there's still a little story. It's a little bit trivial. You don't need all this apparatus. In this context, it seems like the five-dimensional case doesn't quite make any sense. But, and as you said, formulas suddenly go wrong.
In the field theory side, you consider twisted compactification on a Riemann surface, right? Does it affect the unitarity of the theory?
No. The main thing you need to do is, typically you break supersymmetry if you do that. So you have to definitely align your fluxes so that you preserve supersymmetry. That's the topological twist. But the unitarity is...
It's in the tunnel direction.
These are global symmetries that you're just switching on. So you've got a field theory with some global symmetry, and then you just switch on a background of those global symmetries, and that's... I don't think... Is there a reason why you're thinking of...
Because is that the way that Witten constructs it?
Yeah, exactly.
I think Witten's theories are not in general unitary, right?
Yeah, but you think of tunnels. The space-time is what is telecom compactifying the spatial part.
Yeah, so it's the internal space, yeah.
Any questions or comments?
Thank you.